Well, in the spring of 1770, an explorer named Captain James Cook was piloting his ship, the Endeavour, through the Pacific Ocean and came upon the eastern shore of the island of Australia. They were the first Europeans to have ever encountered Australia. And they stopped in that spring to spend a little time exploring the land, meeting some of the Aboriginal inhabitants of Australia. And then they took the ship and sailed north, kind of around the eastern shore of Australia, what is today Queensland. And on June 11th of 1770, the Endeavour struck a reef. It caused a great deal of damage to the ship. And so Captain Cook turned the ship and decided to take it into deeper waters where they would be safe. And as they piloted into deeper waters, they hit the reef again. This time it caused considerable damage to the ship, so much so that it had to be grounded. And for 7 weeks, the crew drove the ship aground and repaired and refitted the ship for the voyage. Captain Cook, in the ship's log, noted, he said this, the north point, that is the north point of this area, was called Cape Tribulation, because here began all of our troubles. Here began all our troubles. You know, last week when we talked about James chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, we likened our trials and the circumstances of life to a dodgeball game. Sometimes that's how it feels, like a middle school recess where dodgeballs are flying at you at rapid pace. And if you may avoid a few of those dodgeballs, but sooner or later you're going to get hit. Here's another illustration of life, too. It's like sailing a ship. Some days may seem fine and the weather's great and the wind is in your sails, but some days you hit the reef. You don't see it coming and crash upon the reef. Now, one blessing out of that, Captain Cook discovered the Great Barrier Reef, the first European to do so. But at what cost? You know, when it comes to our lives, avoiding trials is not an option. You know, that would be the aim if you were piloting a ship like the Endeavour. The aim is don't hit the reef. Well, as believers and as human beings, our object can't be, well, let's just avoid all trials. That's impossible. Come upon us in rapid succession, some large, some small. We can't avoid them. But we can navigate them. We can navigate them in a way that honors God and makes the most of our difficulties. The question that we have to ask is how? How do we make the most of them? Or how? Another way to ask the question, what do we do when we don't know what to do? What do we do when we don't know what to do, when trials come and life becomes hard? It's not always obvious. You know, take this for example. What if you're experiencing a great deal of trials at your job? You might wonder, does God want me to quit and find something better, or should I stick it out and endure? Or maybe you're dealing with a situation with a child who's turned away from the faith and making very poor decisions. How do you counsel that child without pushing them away? What do you do when you don't know what to do? We need wisdom for that. Really, there's two questions that kind of come to our minds when trials come upon us. Number one, we want to know, what's the purpose in this? What is this all for? What's it accomplishing? And then the second question we're wondering about is, well, what do I do? How do I navigate the trial in the first place? Do I say something? Do I not say something? Do I stay? Do I go? What do I do? That's the help that we need. Now, I'm no expert when it comes to navigating trials. In fact, I would say if I look at my life, I've not had a great deal of trials, certainly not as many as some have. But I am a fellow traveler in this. Like you, I want to know how to navigate trials. I want to know how to please God with how I respond. Well, James helps us here. Not only does he tell us count it all joy, but in verses 5 through 8, he shows that we need God-given wisdom to respond well in trials. If we want to respond well, if we want to honor God, to make the most of our trials, if we want to know what to do when we don't know what to do, seek God-given wisdom. That's the only way we're going to respond well to trials. Now, we kind of stopped midstream here in our study in James, because really, verses 2 through 8 is all one section. And we kind of cut it in half. But you'll see, one thing that's really neat about James is he links his thoughts together with what are called catchwords. So one word leads into the next phrase. Let me show this to you. He says in verse 2, "Count it all joy, brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds." So we have trials. And that trials leads into the next verse. "And you know that testing of your faith," that is trials, "produce steadfastness." Then he takes that word steadfastness and sows it into the next verse and says, "And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." Notice that phrase, lacking nothing? He takes that and expands it in the next verse. He says, "If you lack wisdom, let him ask of God." So these aren't just random thoughts that James is just throwing on a page haphazardly. There's a flow to it. And my point in saying all that is that when he says, "If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God," it's not like James has totally switched gears. It's not like he says, now we talked about trials, now I want to talk about wisdom. No, this is wisdom for trials. The context is the same. So how do we find wisdom, God-given wisdom, to properly navigate our trials? And that's what he wants to discuss with us in verses 5 through 8. So if you want to respond well to trials, if you want to make sense of what you're going through, if you want to learn the lessons that God is teaching you, you're going to need God-given wisdom. And James gives us three steps to finding this wisdom. Three steps. I want to share them with you this morning, starting in verse 5. The first step is acknowledge you need wisdom. That's where this whole journey begins. Acknowledge that you need wisdom. You know, if we want help navigating trials, the first thing we have to know is that we need help. And then sometimes that's the hardest step of all, is acknowledging, you know what, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to fix this. Because, and I'll speak here as a man, men especially, I think, are fixers. That's kind of the way our brains are wired. All right, trial has come. How do I fix this? How do I make this work? How do we make the most of this? But sometimes we have to admit, you know what, I don't know. I don't know how to fix this. I need help from outside. Look at verse 5. He says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God." By the way, it's stated as a conditional. It's stated as an if you lack wisdom. But James is assuming that to be true. In fact, the grammar of this verse indicates that he's assuming that you're going to lack wisdom. You can almost translate it, "when you lack wisdom," or "since you lack wisdom, ask God." It's not like, well, just in case, you know, you imagine that you hit some trial you can't figure out, maybe then you'll have to ask. No, James is assuming this is something we're all going to need. And yet, this is not oftentimes how we respond, by immediately reaching out to ask for God's wisdom. In fact, our prayers, probably when trials come, are more like this: "Lord, take this away now. Make this better." Instead of saying, "Lord, what can I learn through this? What do you want me to see? How do you want me to respond?" We say, "Lord, take it away." So if we're going to ask for wisdom, we have to be, first of all, acknowledge, yeah, I lack wisdom. I need help. The goal of Christian maturity is to be whole, lacking nothing, he said in the previous verse. None of us have reached that point. None of us have reached the point where we lack nothing. But one thing that we often lack is wisdom. But we have to know that we need it. You know, if we think to ourselves, "Oh, I got this. This is fine," then we're never going to reach out for help. We're never going to ask God for that wisdom that we so desperately need. And really, it comes down to pride, right? We're prideful people. And we think, I can take care of this. I don't need help. It kind of reminds me, and this is a bit of a personal confession here, it reminds me of going to Lowe's. Or Home Depot, if you prefer, but we'll just use Lowe's for the sake of example. I got to go to Lowe's to pick up something for a project I'm doing at the house. And I'll go in the store, and to be honest, I have no idea where I'm supposed to go. I mean, I know what I'm looking for, but I don't know where in the store it is. So I wander all the way down from one side, and then I go back an aisle, and I go down, you know, crisscross the store this way and that way. I've been doing this for about 20 minutes, and finally an employee stops me and says, "Hey, can I help you find anything?" You know what I say? No, I know what I'm doing. Do I know what I'm doing? No, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know where in the store I am, much less where I'm looking for anything. No, I'm good. Thank you. And then after another 30 minutes, I walk the store another time, zigzag through, and eventually I come upon whatever it is I'm looking for and check out. And, you know, there's an hour wasted. But I think you can probably sympathize with that story, because that's how we are sometimes. Instead of asking for help, or instead of receiving help when it's offered, it's, "Oh, no, I got this. I'm good." I don't want to seem like I'm one of those, you know, people who doesn't know their way around Lowe's, for heaven's sake. And that's sometimes how we are in trials. "Oh, I know how to handle this. I know what to do." Or maybe when it comes to searching for help, we search not from God, but we think to ourselves, you know, "What book can I read? What website can I go to that's going to help me make sense of what's going on in my life? Give me some pointers." Maybe we try and call somebody that we know. Maybe we think to ourselves, I can get counseling. I can, find somebody who can guide me through this. Now, some of those are very helpful, right? There are books that can help you make sense of what's happening to you. So I'm not disparaging any of those. But what we really need is God's wisdom. And that only comes from those who ask. So if any of you lacks wisdom, he doesn't say, if any of you lacks wisdom, go take a seminar. Go to Bible college. Go talk to a friend. No, he says, if you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. That's where you're going to find it. That's where you're going to find that wisdom we need for those troubles. Now, again, we've talked about troubles big and small. Now, some of the smaller ones, you know, maybe they kind of roll off our back pretty easily. But sooner or later, you're going to encounter troubles that you're not going to know what to do with. I don't know how to act. I don't know what this is leading to. I don't know what all this means. In that case, we need to ask of God. Knowing that you need wisdom is a sign of wisdom itself. Thomas Jefferson, our third president, once said this: "The wise know too well their own weakness to assume infallibility. He who knows most knows how little he knows." He who knows most knows how little he knows. And the one who is wisest is the one who knows he needs wisdom most. So let's take a minute to define what he means here when he says, "If you lack wisdom." Wisdom is one of those topics that is all over in the Bible, New Testament, Old Testament, and it's one that's very dear to James. He talks about it here in the first chapter. He'll later on talk about it in other places. And the reason I think it's so dear to James is because it touches on the very reason that he's writing. See, wisdom is about practicality. It's about applying truth to real-life situations. And that seems to be the thing that James is countering here in this brief little letter. He's basically saying to his readers, "You have faith, wonderful. Let's see how it handles in the real world. Show your faith. Demonstrate your faith through how you live in the practical." So wisdom is that practical. You know, it's practically oriented, but it's biblically tuned. It's biblical wisdom, you know, derived from Scripture, but lived out practically. So in the context of trials, the wisdom we seek is practical. It's not, you know, "Lord, give me some, you know, philosophical, theological answer to why I'm suffering." No, the person who lacks wisdom says, "Lord, help me do what's right in the midst of this trial. Show me the practical, the how-to. What do I say? What do I do? How do I embrace the right attitude when I'm going through this trial?" You might remember last week we said that learning to count it all joy involves us choosing to see our trials from God's perspective, not our own. So if we're going to count trials joy, it means we have to look at them not as trials, you know, "Oh, this hurts." We have to say, "Yeah, it hurts, but God is doing something through it. And how do we get that God perspective of our trials, that perspective that transcends our own pain? Where does that come from? It comes from God. It comes from wisdom. Ask for it. So if you can't make sense and say, I don't know why this is happening to me, I don't know what to do in the midst of my trial, first of all, acknowledge that you need wisdom. You need it. So when it comes to trials, the question is, how do we respond properly? That takes wisdom. So acknowledge your need for wisdom, and second, ask God for wisdom. Ask God for wisdom. This is all in verse 5. If any of you lacks, which we do, which we need to acknowledge, what should we do? Let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Now, maybe that seems overly simple to you. We need wisdom, so we just ask God. That's all there is to it. We just ask him, and he gives it. Yeah, it's that simple. It doesn't need to be more complicated. Do you feel confused about what God's doing in your life? Do you wonder how you should react? Well, ask for wisdom. Seeing our lives from God's point of view is what we need, and it doesn't come naturally. I want to note a couple things here in verse 5 that he draws out. First of all, I want to talk about the generosity of God. So we're supposed to ask God. Okay, that's great. Does God want to give us wisdom? Yes, of course. The generosity of God. It says, God who gives generously to all without reproach. That's the nature of God. God's not stingy when it comes to distributing wisdom, especially to his children, right? I mean, here's God's child coming to him and asking for wisdom. God's not going to say, you know, come on, Reed. What are you talking about? No. God is generous. He delights to answer his children. A couple of things about the generosity of God. First of all, it is abundant. It's abundant. Or another way we could say this is overflowing. He doesn't just give, he gives generously. Or some versions will say he gives liberally. In other words, he's overflowing in his givingness. One possible way to translate this is, he gives without hesitation. Think about that. You know, if you ask somebody for something and they kind of hesitate, I don't know. That tells you that they're kind of rethinking. I don't know if I want to give this to you or not. God gives without hesitation. You ask for it, okay, here it is. It's generous. It's gracious in his giving. Now, some people would say, well, I faced a trial, and I asked God for wisdom, and you know what? I didn't get an answer. I still don't know why I'm suffering. I still don't know what to do. So God let me down. Well, it wasn't that God was withholding an answer. Maybe they weren't asking the right question. Or maybe something else got in the way. In fact, in the next few verses, James is going to talk about he who doubts and who doesn't receive this wisdom. But the problem is not in God. It's not that God is somehow withholding wisdom from us that we need. No, God is anxious to give it to us. He's overflowing. He's abundant in his generosity. Secondly, he's unprejudiced. It says here he is without reproach to all. So when God is approached by his children, and by the way, it says to all. So it's not just me, it's not just some privileged few, it's all of God's children are invited to come and receive generously from God, but he is without reproach. When we ask wisdom for God, God doesn't look at us, or maybe I should say it this way, God doesn't look down on us for asking. God doesn't look down on us when we ask for wisdom. I'm guessing somewhere along the way, you probably had a teacher, maybe if it was even your own parent, who told you, and this is kind of one of those teacherisms, I guess. You know, a teacher begins class and says, I want you to understand the material that we're covering in this class, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Then they add this little line, there are no dumb questions. Have you ever heard that? A teacher say, there are no dumb questions. And then, like, within 10 minutes, that thesis is thoroughly challenged in the classroom when somebody raises their hand and asks a question that you're just like, and I've seen this happen with teachers where they don't necessarily say it. They don't come out and say, well, that's a stupid question. But the look in their eyes says it for them. Like, are you really asking that? We've all been there, right? Maybe we've been on the other end of asking a stupid question. And you have that glare, you know, what a foolish question to ask. God never does that. When it comes to his children asking for wisdom, he doesn't say, you're gonna ask me for wisdom. He doesn't reproach us. He doesn't hold us in contempt. I mean, imagine if all the requests God hears for wisdom, you know, can you imagine if God looked down at us and said, isn't your situation so obvious? Like, why are you so thick-headed that you don't understand this? You know, there must be something really wrong with you. Or maybe we come to God with a request for wisdom for the 50th time, and God says, listen, I've been here before. You've asked for this before. Why don't you understand? Come on. Get it through your thick skull. God doesn't do that. He doesn't reproach those who approach him for wisdom. He delights to give. Jesus in Luke chapter 11 told a parable of a father and a son. And he was teaching his disciples about prayer. And he said, who of you, if your son asks for, you know, bread or anything, you know, he gives him a snake or a stone instead? He says, if you know how to give good gifts, how much more does your heavenly Father know how to give? And kind of applying that teaching here, you know, if we know how to treat our children gently and carefully, you know, again, if one of my kids came to me asking, hey, can you help me? Can you give me some wisdom? Or maybe one of your kids comes to you and says, hey, can you give me some wisdom for how to deal with a situation in my life? Are you going to fold your arms and say, well, you should have come last year? You should have come a lot earlier than now. No, you would be delighted to help them. And if we do that, then how much more does God graciously give? So we see the generosity of God in verse 5, but we also recognize the danger of doubt. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. It will be given. It's a promise. Then verse 6 says, but let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. So there is an obstacle to receiving wisdom, but it's not God and it's not asking. It's not in him, it is in us. So there's a condition upon this request. It must be asked with faith. He must believe and not doubt. Now when we read the word doubt, you might think of a person who's doubting God. I'm not sure, God, if you're there. Or maybe they're doubting God's promises. God, I'm not sure if you're going to answer my request for wisdom. But the word James uses here indicates not a person who is full of doubts in that sense, but somebody who is divided. It has the idea of a person with a divided mind or being pulled in two directions at the same time. And I think that's kind of an important observation. We're going to talk about it more in just a moment. But right now, I want to reinforce this idea. The second step in making sense of your trials is ask God for wisdom. Again, that's not our first reaction always. You know, we might look to somewhere else. We might try and find wisdom on our own. But God says the place to find it is to ask. So if you're going through a trial and life is hard and you don't know what to do, ask God. Lord, help me to make the right decisions. Help me to respond in a way that glorifies you to this trial. And I think we can also ask, Lord, help me to see why this is in my life. I do believe that God, not always, but sometimes, allows us to see why trials take place. We'll say more about that as we kind of come to the end of this message. But I want to get to the third and final step here of making sense of our trials. So we need to acknowledge that we need wisdom. We need to ask God for wisdom. And then third, we need to accept God's wisdom. So there's the formula. Acknowledge, ask, accept. Know that you need it, ask for it, and then accept it. And I think this last one is quite important because he spends several verses talking about it. Verses 6 and 7, listen to this. Let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. So if you ask and you're this doubter, you're not going to get an answer. You're not going to get what you're after. So there's two warnings here I want to give. First of all, don't be a doubter. Don't be a doubter. This is really kind of the prerequisite to receiving the kind of wisdom that we need. Now, we already saw we're supposed to ask in faith. And we also noted that the word doubt has the idea of being two-minded, of being drawn in two different directions. So what does this mean exactly? What does it mean to doubt? Now, I would have told you this. So upon first reading, and probably previous times when I've read through James, this is how I took it. If any of you doubts, you're not going to receive anything from the Lord. I took it as you just got to believe really, really hard that God's going to give you an answer. And if you have any kind of, if you have any kind of doubt in your mind or in your heart that God's really going to answer that prayer of in faith, then you're not going to get it. So in other words, you have to kind of like hit this base level of faith in order to get an answer. If you fall short of that level of faith, you're not going to get one. And I think that's probably how a lot of us have taken this. But let me ask a couple questions. Number one, what does it mean to doubt in this context? Being divided in mind, pulled in different directions. This is somebody who is compelled by competing desires. So rather than having a settled direction, going one way, he's trying to go both ways. So his prayer is one saying, Lord, give me wisdom, but he doesn't really want the wisdom that God gives. Does that make sense? So let me make this as plain as I can. What does it mean to doubt in this context? It means to not be committed to accepting God's wisdom when it's given. In other words, if our attitude is, God, show me how to respond to this trial, and then God gives us an answer and we say, not the answer I was hoping for. I think I'll try it my own way now. Or maybe we pray, Lord, show me what to do in this circumstance. And God shows us, nope, sorry, that's too hard. No thanks. That's this divided, doubting heart. It's not so much that you have to live up to a certain level of faith. You know, you have to have the faith of Peter or the faith of Abraham in order to, you know, get an answer from prayer. No, what it means to not doubt is to accept God's wisdom. Be willing to take whatever God tells you is the answer, to take it and do it. Because if you don't, then you're like this doubter tossed by the waves of the sea. So praying, Lord, teach me in this trial what you want me to do, and then holding on to veto power that we can sort of, oh, no, I'm gonna go a different direction. Well, that's not accepting God's wisdom. That's being a doubter. Now, James describes this person in verse 6 as one like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. James, half-brother of Jesus, grew up not very far from the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is not really much of a sea. It's kind of a big lake. But the topography of Galilee is such that the mountains around the sea actually channels the wind through so that that sea can become quite rough when the winds blow. And James is probably thinking of those rough days on the Sea of Galilee when he says this. The winds blow across the surface of the water and the water just gets churned up. That's why Jesus and his disciples, when they were out on the boat, thought they were going to die. The sea could become quite rough, quite disturbed. And he says that's what the inner life of this doubter is like. They're all churned up. They're not going in one direction. They're not committed to God's way. They're asking God for wisdom, but not willing to accept it when it's given. They're unstable. They go wherever the wind blows. And that's the nature of the doubter. By the way, I love James' use of illustration here. He does this all throughout his letter. He's really a master at kind of drawing these mental pictures. Here's the doubter. He's like a sea all choppy and waves being blown about. You know, he doesn't have a settled direction. He's blown wherever the wind takes him. So what does it mean to doubt? Really, it means to approach God asking for wisdom without the desire to accept it. All right, well, what does doubt produce then? Well, it produces instability. We already saw that. But it also, I guess on the negative side, it doesn't produce an answer. Right? Look at verse 7. For the person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. If you're this doubtful person, if you say, I want God's wisdom, but I'll wait and decide whether or not I really want to obey it. Well, don't expect an answer from God. Why is God going to give you an answer if you're not even willing to agree to follow his wisdom? I mean, it'd be wasted wisdom, wouldn't it? If God grants it and then we say, I think I'll pass. So don't be a doubter. Here's the second warning. Don't be double-minded. Now, you'll notice that these two overlap, right? I mean, doubter and double-minded are describing the same person. But look at verse 8. He says, he, that is this doubter, is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. The doubter is double-minded. And James uses a word here. Many believe that he actually coined this term. He created it. Double-minded. It's a Greek word, and it's pronounced dipsukes, which is kind of a fun word to say, dipsukes. It kind of sounds like an insult, doesn't it? You dipsukes. But it really means two-souled. So sukes is where we get the word psyche, like psychology, referring to the soul or to the mind or to the inner person. And so dipsukes is to be two-souled, to be double-minded, to be a split personality almost. Their loyalties, their heart is split. John Bunyan, in his classic Allegory of the Pilgrim's Progress, describes a character he calls Mr. Facing Both Ways. It's this character who, you know, can never make up his mind. He can never be truly committed to one way or the other because he's Mr. Facing Both Ways. That's the double-minded man. Now, we can be double-minded in many different ways. Let me suggest one to you very quickly, and that is one way we can be double-minded, or people can be, is when people ask God for wisdom, but they don't really know Jesus as their Savior. You'll hear this a lot. Sometimes you'll even hear, like, Hollywood celebrities and stuff. Oh, yeah, I pray every day. I pray every day. And I don't think that they're lying about that. But if you look at the quality of their life and what they really believe, there's nothing to suggest that they're following Jesus. Yet they say, I pray every day. That's double-minded to say, hey, God, I want your wisdom. I want to follow you. But I don't really believe the truth about Jesus. I don't belong to him. So these are people who pray to the Lord when things get hard. They want to know his way, but they don't want to know Christ. They don't want to give their life to him. It says we must believe and not doubt. I guess the question is, are you a follower of Christ Jesus? Are you his? Because, you know, a double-minded person can come to church and they can read the Bible and they can do all the religious things, but if they don't know and have a relationship with Jesus Christ, they're double-minded. And the way of the double-minded is destruction. He says here he's unstable in all his ways. Another way a person can be double-minded is, as we've already described, with the doubter. You know, I need wisdom. I don't want to know what to do. But when we get wisdom, we say no thank you. So ultimately, we need to ask for God's wisdom. We need to acknowledge that we need it. We need to ask for it, and then we need to accept it. We need to have an open heart to receive the wisdom. Don't bother praying for God's wisdom if you're not willing to accept it and receive it and do it. Somebody once said, to profit from good advice requires more wisdom than to give it. Let me say that again. To profit from good advice requires more wisdom than to give it. In other words, we need more wisdom to be able to receive instruction. And that's what we have to do when it comes to the Lord. Whenever he gives wisdom, it is wisdom to receive it, to accept it. So let me close this out. What do you do when you don't know what to do? When you're at the end of your rope, when trials come and you don't know how to respond to the trials, and you don't know what the meaning of any of it is, what do? Well, you properly navigate those hardships. You acknowledge that you need wisdom, you ask for it, and when you get it, you accept it. You do it. So let me close with two very quick thoughts. Number one, God's wisdom helps us understand the blessing of trials. Which, by the way, is such an unusual term, right? Blessing of trials. I thought trials were painful and difficult and hard. They are, but they're also a blessing. I want you to jump down in James chapter 1 to verse 12. This is kind of the capstone verse on this whole discussion of trials. He says, "Blessed is the man." By the way, do you notice that echo from the Beatitudes? Jesus says, "Blessed is he." James says, well, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trials. He who endures, who has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love it. So, blessed is the man who endures trials. We need God's wisdom because, you know, if we look at our lives and we look at our trials from a purely earthly point of view, it's going to look like a disaster. But when we have God's wisdom, we're able to see at least a little bit more than we do now, we can understand they are blessings. God sends trials to us to improve us, to prepare us, to bless us. Secondly, not only does God's wisdom help us to understand the blessing, God's answer is not usually immediate. God's answer is not usually immediate. So if you pray and ask, God, give me wisdom, show me what I'm supposed to do in this trial. It's not as if God zaps you instantly and it's like, oh, I suddenly know exactly what I should do. It usually comes with time, especially when it comes to praying for insight into what God is doing. Oftentimes that takes years to be revealed. But I think it is an answer to that prayer, isn't it? I mean, if we pray, God, help me to see what you're doing through this, and then 10 years later you can look back and say, you know what? God was doing something there. That's an answer to that prayer. It's not an immediate answer, but it is an answer. And I think that's a very appropriate way to pray, by the way. God may not show us. Maybe we'll have to wait for eternity to learn all the ins and outs of why God sent us the challenges that he did. But I think it is appropriate to say, God, I want to know what you're doing through this trial. You know, God uses our sufferings to allow us to sympathize with those. Sometimes he allows us trials to give us opportunities we would have never had. I want to close this morning with just a brief story. I think it illustrates this point that God's answers are not immediate. I've been studying the book of James, and one resource that has helped me immensely is a commentary on the book of James by a guy named D. Edmund Hebert. It's the best I've found on the book, and so if you're ever studying James and you want a resource, I recommend it. It was written by D. Edmund Hebert, and everything I've read of his is extremely helpful, but his story is interesting. He was born in 1910 in a small farming community in Kansas. He grew up on a farm, but his heart was never really in farming. His nose was always in a book. His dad records that, you know, even when he was out on the farm, he would always have a book with him, and any spare moment he'd be reading. He was a very, bookish type person. Well, eventually his love for learning and his love for the Lord came together when he went to Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. In the 1940s, he was a student there, and eventually he earned his doctorate and went out to become a teacher. But in January of 1944, D. Edmund Hebert came down with an infection. Not exactly sure where he got it, but he was hospitalized for 110 days. It's a long time. And they didn't know what to do or how to help him. Eventually, he was able to improve enough that he could go home. But then when he finally did return home, he had dizzy spells and ringing in his ears, and his eyesight was impaired. So doctors were still trying to figure out what was happening and how they could help him. Well, by the time they actually were able to discover what was going on, his hearing was beyond repair. In November of 1946, his hearing went entirely. He was completely deaf. And he talks about this time of his life as being terrifying, to suddenly be isolated in this world of silence. By the way, Hebert's first daughter was born in October of 1946. He never heard her voice. So he lived in this utter silence of deafness. Well, many years later, D. Edmund Hebert spoke about his deafness and how it contributed to his life. Here's what he said. "Obviously, it has closed many doors of distraction to me. It has given me a deeper sense of biblical understanding. I probably never would have written the books I have had I not lost my hearing." You see, that was years later that he understood, you know, God knew what he was doing when he took my hearing from me. And it allowed him to dive deeper into his studies. It allowed him to write books that, like he said, I never would have written had I not lost my hearing. And I think about that now. 2025, I have been blessed and helped in my study of James by D. Edmund Hebert, who lost his hearing, and without which probably never would have written that book. And I'm certainly not the only one who has benefited from his insights into James. So I'm standing here as one who has a direct beneficiary of D. Edmund Hebert's deafness. You see, those aren't answers we get immediately. But as we pray for wisdom, I do believe that God will, in time, show us, here's what I was doing with those trials. So if you're going through a trial, acknowledge, ask, and accept the wisdom of God.